Chapter 19. Two Meetings and a Marriage. The Dharma Parishad was almost over when one of the organisers told me that another Buddhist delegate had arrived and would be presiding over the day's proceedings. The first time we found ourselves on the platform together, the new arrival and I eyed each other dubiously. What he thought of me, I never knew. My first impressions of him were somewhat mixed. Despite his age and corpulence, Panditji, as the organisers respectfully called him, was both strong and active. His brow was noble and intellectual, but counterbalanced by crafty eyes and a weak, self-indulgent mouth. Though affable and condescending in the extreme, his manner was very much that of the grand seigneur. From his scholarly presidential address, delivered with a cultured accent in impeccable English, I understood that, though representing Buddhism, he was himself a Hindu. This double allegiance puzzled me, for I had not then grasped the fact that the average Hindu considers he understands any other religion better and is therefore more truly qualified to represent it than its own professed adherents. As the only two Buddhist delegates, Panditji and I, despite my misgivings, inevitably became acquainted. When the Parishad had ended, and I had shifted from the school to the office of the convening organisation, he and his companion, a well-fleshed, lethargic young Bengali named Sudhir, took me out with them on excursions. Together we visited a temple of the Narayana Swami sect, which has a considerable following in Gujarat. From the opposite banks of the river, we viewed the low, red-tiled roofs of the Sabarmati Ashram, from which, for many years, Mahatma Gandhi had directed the struggle for independence. Once, Panditji took me back with him for lunch to the imitation marble villa of the millionaire Ahmedabad mill owner with whom he and Sudhir were staying. Though the meal was served in Indian style, it transpired that the sons and daughters of the house were rather westernised. The old scholar, who had once been their tutor, was asked his opinion of the latest divorce. His courteous and compliant reply showed that, whatever he really thought, he had no intention of giving offence. For all his grey hairs, Panditji's energy was prodigious. One day he told me he had arranged for Anandamayi Ma's 51st birthday to be celebrated in the town hall. The name was new to me. On my questioning him, he told me, with a solemn air, that she was a great saint and yogini who had thousands of disciples all over northern India. Her peculiarities were numerous. One of them was that, despite the entreaties of devotees, she never stayed longer than a few weeks in any one place. Her entourage had to be ready to leave at a moment's notice, for sometimes, when the spirit moved her, she simply walked out of the ashram or dharmasala at which they were camping without giving any warning. In fact, her movements were quite unpredictable. No one ever knew what the blissful mother would do next. From the complacency with which Panditji related these facts, I inferred that in his eyes, as in those of most Hindus, such irresponsibility was a sign of high spiritual attainment. To me it seemed more likely that Anandamayi had a shrewd sense of the dramatic. However, being interested in anyone with a reputation for sanctity, I inquired where she was at that time staying. Mentioning the name of a certain town, Panditji said that, having already spent a couple of weeks there, she was expected soon to be on the move again. But where she would go next, no one knew. She might come to Ahmedabad, which she had already visited once. Or perhaps she would go to Dehra Dun. She might even return to Benares, where a large ashram was being constructed in her name on the sacred banks of the Ganges. He himself, Panditji confided, wished to meet her again at the earliest opportunity. As soon as he heard that she had reached Dehradun, the place she was most likely to visit next, he and Sudhir intended to hasten to her feet. Would I care to accompany them? Anandamayi was very sympathetic towards Buddhism, and had in fact given her approval of his project of reviving an organization for the propagation of the Dharma in India, which he had started many years earlier. She would assuredly welcome me. Perhaps, under Anandamayi's guidance, he and Sudhir and I could work together for the revival of Buddhism in India. When Panditji unfolded a plan, he was irresistible. Vista upon entrancing vista opened up as though by magic. Touched by the wand of his imagination, possibilities were transformed into actualities, and impossibilities into reasonable expectations. Even afterwards, when it became clear that none of his grandiose schemes had ever progressed beyond the fundraising stage, I had to struggle hard to prevent myself from being carried away by the old man's eloquence. On the day we discussed the celebration of Anandamayi's birthday, I could not but be persuaded. Indeed, with Banerjee's parting words ringing in my ears, I had been casting about for contacts with Buddhist organizations ever since my arrival in Ahmedabad, and Panditji's offer opened the door. But so long as we were waiting for news of Anandamayi's arrival in Dehradun, our plans could be no more than tentative. Meanwhile, a meeting in honour of her birthday was held at the town hall, where at my suggestion Panditji also arranged for the celebration of the Vaishakha Purnima a few days later. It is significant that the thrice-sacred Buddhist festival had never been celebrated in Ahmedabad before. At the end of the Vaishakha meeting, at which both Panditji and I spoke, I was approached by a handsome, golden-skinned youth of my own age, who was so taken with the idea of an Englishman being a Buddhist that he insisted on my paying a visit to his home. In vain I demurred. Without giving me time even to tell Panditji where I was going, he caught me by the hand, and before I realized what had happened, we were hurrying through the narrow, crowded streets of the old walled city. On the way, my newly acquired friend told me he was a student in a Bombay medical college. Before long, I found myself for the second time inside an Indian home. Ashok's father, a lawyer, seemed to think it the most natural thing in the world that his son should bring a friend home to spend the night with him, for the masterful youth had already decided I was to stay. And after the exchange of a few friendly words, left us to our own devices. Ashok's hospitality was such that I could not but feel at ease. He arranged a hot bath, which I took in a bathroom full of highly polished brass vessels of various shapes and sizes, lent me a shirt and lungi, and took away my own clothes to be washed and ironed. By the time we sat down to dinner, I was a member of the family. From the cage-like kitchen, where he squatted on the floor in front of a low, cow-dung-plastered brick range, the Brahmin cook flipped paper-thin chapatis straight from the fire onto our round brass plates. Ashok had arranged for us to sleep on the roof, as we climbed to the top of the building, which was built around a square well, with inward-facing verandas on all four sides of each story. I noticed that in the corner of every landing, a large built-in urinal of white porcelain. Despite the exposed position of these conveniences, I saw Ashok and the rest of the family using them without the slightest self-consciousness. Out on the roof, the night was brilliant with the moon. After we had lain talking for a couple of hours, I dropped off to sleep. Once during the night I awoke to find a dazzlingly bright golden face immediately above my own. But whether Ashok's or the moon's, I could not tell. This visit, which at Ashok's insistence I repeated, helped while away the time until the whimsical Anandamayi should have made up her mind what to do next. Not that I was either lonely or bored. People came almost every day to see me, and besides excursions with Panditji, there were invitations to the houses of other friends I had made. One of these was a dark, diminutive coal merchant, at whose house I usually lunched, and who was always at hand to supply anything I needed. Another was a lawyer with literary pretensions. At our first meeting, he presented me with autographed copies of half a dozen slim volumes, all published at his own expense. As the custom is in India, with books of a religious nature, the author's photograph figured prominently in every one of them. Back in my quarters, I examined these gifts with interest. It would be difficult to say whether style or subject matter struck me as being the more odd. The first was strained to the highest pitch of perfervid bombast. In the second, the author's first wife having died young, apostrophes to the deity were strangely mingled with laments for the loss of conjugal felicity. Once, at the invitation of the rather youthful bridegroom, I attended a Hindu wedding. When the procession, led by a hired brass band, reached the bride's house, where the ceremony was to be performed, a heated argument ensued between the representatives of the two families. The subject under dispute, I was informed, was the number of the bridegroom's friends to be admitted to the marriage feast. The bridegroom insisted on 20. His future father-in-law, who was, of course, the founder of the feast, declared he could feed no more than 12. Guests at a European banquet would feel embarrassed, if not insulted, to hear the question of whether they were to be fed or not discussed with so much feeling in public. But in Gujarat, if not elsewhere in India, disputes of this kind were all part of the traditional marriage observances. Whether 12 or 20 of us eventually took our seats on the dining room floor, I no longer remember. Ever anxious not to offend socio-religious susceptibilities, my mind was occupied by the hints on Hindu etiquette just given me by the bridegroom. Above all, he had said, I must on no account touch my plate with my left hand. If I did so, even by accident, the other guests would regard it as a grievous insult and might even get up and leave the room. The result of this friendly admonition was that throughout the meal I remained fearfully conscious of my left hand, which seemed to have grown unnaturally large and heavy, for despite my efforts to hold it behind my back, it had apparently developed a will of its own, which impelled it ever and anon in the direction of my plate. The sudden arrival of the news that Anandamayi was in Dehradun threw Panditji, Sudhir and me into a flutter, which her going there in accordance with a previously announced programme could never have occasioned. Travelling via New Delhi, in less than 2 days we had made the journey from Ahmedabad to Dehradun, a distance of about 600 miles, and were alighting from the bus at Kishanganj, an outlying suburb halfway between Dehradun town and the hill station proper. On the opposite side of the road, I saw an open gate, surmounted by a lofty semicircular arch, on which was inscribed, Shri, 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 Ma, Anandamayi, Ashram.